Hi, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut, what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it.
Abby has lived and breathed my mental health issues with me. When I started this podcast, she said she wanted to tell her side of the story as well in an episode. The side which is often overlooked. The pressure, strain, heartache, and often overall sense of hopelessness that family, wives, girlfriends, husbands, boyfriends, and friends, or whoever you may be, endure, trying to support someone with mental health issues is huge. And it's a side of the story which deserves an awful lot of attention. Abby talks about beginning to see the signs in me that there was something not quite right. What it was like hearing your loved one say he didn't want to wake up anymore. And the everyday ups and downs of depression and anxiety from a partner's perspective. Abby also gives her advice to anybody who is worried about a loved one battling mental health issues and the mistakes she learned early on in dealing with me. I must admit, this is an episode I'm nervous to release, but I hope it shows others out there they're not alone. Here is Abby's story, so please, as always, leave all judgment at the door.
Hi, welcome to the RUP.
Thank you.
How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Nervous?
A little bit, yeah.
As am I.
Good. Good start.
Yeah. Why did you want to come on the podcast?
I think really what I kind of boiled it down to is this is a podcast about experiences of men's mental health. And this is me sharing my experience of your mental health. But also I'm hoping that, you know, when this all started, I didn't know where to turn. I didn't have any resources available. I didn't know where to start. And I'm hoping that, you know, just like men might listen to the podcast and relate, you know, someone else's partner might listen to this and relate and might resonate and might, you know, provide some kind of support.
Amazing. Well, I'm quite nervous about about what's going to be discussed, given that it was my mental health which has caused these series of unfortunate events. Yeah, let's get on with it.
Great.
What type of person was I when we first met?
You were pretty ambitious, driven, very work oriented, very focused on the success of your business. And I think what you had imagined would be your success in life. So I think you had a very clear idea of where you wanted to go and how you were going to get there. And you were very focused on that. That was an absolute priority for you. And actually, on our first date, I remember you asked me what I wanted from life. And I said, I want to be happy. And you laughed and just said, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. You've got to do better than that. And I said, well, no, that's what I want for my life. I want to be happy. What do you want? And you said, I want to be successful. And I think that really captures who you were at the time. You were entirely focused on that. That was your life's aim. But apart from that, we got along very well, obviously.
Why do you think we got along so well?
I just think we have a very similar set of values. I think we have very similar idea of what's right and wrong, of where we lean on certain things that I think are kind of quite important things. I think we want to spend our time the same way, and I think that we also have the same love languages. So I think we kind of we value the same things, you know, we enjoy the same things, we show our affection in the same way. So I think we kind of just clicked quite well very early on. And it just kind of went from there.
We met in June.
Yeah.
Started going out in July.
Yeah.
Very much a whirlwind.
Yeah.
Then there was a series of events that happened which led me into my rut.
Yeah.
From your perspective, what were those timelines of events?
So I think...
Where did it start?
It all started, and I think it's important to say from the beginning that actually looking back on it now, I think it was almost inevitable that you ended up where you ended up.
Agreed.
Because you started, you were on a path with the business side that was almost destined to fail. And even if it succeeded, it would have involved so many knockbacks that even the most resilient person would have struggled to keep themselves positive in that time. But obviously, I think, you know, the longest standing one, really from the moment I met you to pretty much the end of the year, so for about 5-6 months was the business, and you were so focused on the business and raising money and fundraising, and you were reaching out to so many different people to see if they would invest. And even for people who get investment, they get hundreds of no's first, and you got a lot of no's. And
yeah, a lot.
You know, I think it's tough, especially when, you know, you made a lot of progress with people. It wasn't like you were just sending things out and people were just saying no. You know, people were engaging, people were interested. You met a lot of people, you presented to a lot of people, but eventually they said no. And that, I think you took that very personally. It's hard not to, because it's your business, right? Mm. You built it. It's very hard to take a no to your business. It's not a no to you personally. I get that. But it was just, as I say, kind of rejection after rejection. And it feels like, I think when you were talking about the way that, you know, certain funds had picked apart a business plan, or not necessarily kind of negatives they found, but they just said, you know, this just isn't for us because we don't really want to get into this space.
Mm.
It's very hard not to take all of those personally. You know, you start making excuses and being like, okay, well, if they don't want to get into the space, fine. But then it's just like happens again and again and again, and there's all these excuses, and it's hard not to see that the common denominator in all these things is you and the business.
Yeah.
So it's tough not to take that personally. And I think that was kind of ongoing for about, let's say, about 6 months. And then during that time, when frankly you were getting knocked down like every week, you then had the knee injury, which, and I think you played, was what, your second game of rugby back? And, you know, you'd loved that first game. And then the second game, I remember I'd been rushing to try and get to the game to watch you play. I still haven't watched you play a minute of rugby because I turned up. I was literally down the road when one of our friends called me to say, James is a bit hurt, which understatement of the century. And obviously the knee injury just kind of taking you out of rugby
for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I think you know, I remember we were sitting there in minor injuries or wherever we were, and you were messaging people going, yeah, 3 to 6 months. And I was just thinking, no way. This is like 18 months. Obviously praying that you hadn't done the kind of damage that we thought you'd done, trying not to Google, because every time I Googled, I was like just seeing how much damage is done when you dislocate a knee.
Or it comes up with cancer.
Yeah, exactly. It was one of the two. So that was, and obviously just like for about, I think probably for about 2 or 3 weeks, your life, everything went on hold, and both of our lives, while we focused on your knee, because you couldn't walk, you couldn't move from the sofa. It was like moving you from bed to the sofa and back to bed.
Yeah.
And your foot was elevated all the time. And it was, you know, bringing you ice like every hour for an hour just to try and get the swelling down. So, you know, that kind of took you completely out of the game for life for about 3 weeks, just kind of immobilized. And then obviously as we were going through like the process of you going to the doctors and starting to see the fracture clinic, and they did the tests on your they were testing the arteries, I think, because your foot was really cold.
Yeah, they did a CT scan.
Yeah. And then they found your liver problem.
And this was November.
Yeah. Well, October, November time. Yeah. And then they were like, right, no drinking for 6 months. And I think that was, in a way, I remember at the time thinking, well, this is actually quite good, because frankly, it's going to be good for your recovery, it'd be good for your rehab to, you know, not be drinking. I think actually it was great that you weren't drinking, because I dread to think what sort of a place you'd have ended up in if you had been drinking as well. And I bravely / stupidly said that I would stop drinking with you, as a kind of show of solidarity, which I loved for about 3 weeks and then got really annoyed about. I think kind of what I noticed after the rugby injury, you wanted to go down and watch the rugby, but it was physically hard to get you there for a while because you couldn't stand. And obviously you then couldn't join the drinks afterwards. So I think kind of I noticed your diary kind of freeing up. And you know, you were probably not through any fault of anyone's kind of just invited to less, because, you know, if everyone's going out to the pub and then going out like on a big night out, you are on crutches, can't stand for very long and can't drink.
Yeah, old Hoppy can't get around, can he?
Not exactly the life and soul of the party.
No.
At that time of, yeah. So, yeah, and then I think kind of running into November, my birthday was in November, and I think kind of in the run up to my birthday, kind of a couple of weeks before my birthday, it looked very positive, like you might get some funding.
Yeah.
And then it all fell down on my birthday.
I set the target of closing a small round by the start of December.
Mm.
Your birthday is the 21st November.
Mm.
Thank God I've just got that right. Yeah, and then on your birthday, well, we got to issuing term sheets with investors and then they pulled out.
Yeah. And I remember on my birthday, you put on a very brave face and had a glass of champagne and tried to smile. And then I think kind of that took so much out of you, putting on a brave face when you did not feel like it, that for a couple of days after that, you were basically in bed, doing not a lot, could barely get up.
Pretty much.
And then we kind of hit December, which had its own challenges, because obviously the Christmas run-in, I was pretty busy every night with parties, things like that, Christmas events. You One, I think in past years with jobs that you've had, you have had that kind of flurry of events around Christmas, but you know,
there was nothing.
Well, obviously with not having like a job which had a Christmas party, like there was that that went, and also just with your knee and not being able to kind of physically get around.
Had you noticed my mental health becoming a bit of an issue, or there was alarm bells just if we go just before Christmas?
To be completely honest, no, I hadn't noticed that you were struggling, but I was pretty amazed that you weren't. I was kind of thinking, God, he's doing really well considering what he's had to go through the last few months. So I think it was, I hadn't actually realized that there was anything wrong, or that you'd been struggling. And then obviously we all kind of went into Christmas and New Year, and I had 2 weeks off over Christmas and New Year, so we basically spent it together.
Yeah, that's great actually.
Yeah, and then, and that was really nice because we were kind of able to be together all day every day, and because I was off work and you weren't working either, it was, we were just able to just like have some really, really good quality time. So that was lovely. And then I remember kind of going back to work and kind of thinking, this is going to be hard.
Start of January.
Yeah. Hard for you, hard for me. Just obviously you get into kind of, I think kind of going back to work in January is always hard anyway, but it was weird because obviously I kind of had this job to go back to and everything was kind of relatively normal. And you, I think, were kind of reassessing really where you wanted to go now. And so you put the business to one side and decided to see if you could get a job.
Yeah, well, I started seeing a therapist by then, Way. Did about 8 sessions with him. And that was mid-December I started that, actually.
Yeah, and I remember thinking that was really good for you because you were saying, you know, you were starting to think about what success was, what it meant to you, and I was thinking that sounds pretty healthy. I think you should do that. So I was really in favour of that. I thought that was great. That kind of probably more life coaching kind of stuff. But it was probably also starting to unpick a lot of who you were and what you'd kind of built what you wanted to do on. So yeah, and then I think probably it was mid-January that you first mentioned something to me.
Yeah, this was a critical point, wasn't it?
And I probably,
because I've been going to interviews and I'd be getting certain feedback from interviews, which wasn't really feedback I ever expected to get.
And it was, I remember then starting to think, he's struggling now. You were really taking the outcomes from the interviews, they were really hitting you hard. Harder than, you know, any normal person would react to a couple of interview rejections. You were really kind of taking them as full-blown attacks on your personality. It was really, every time you got a no, it was like 3 or 4 days before you were able to pick yourself up again. And I was thinking, okay, you're struggling now. And so it wasn't really a huge surprise that you first said that you were struggling. And I think,
run me through that day.
The day when you told me. Well, I just remember that you, for a few days, you'd just been really off. Really had your, like, your mind had been elsewhere. And then on that day, you again, I think we made dinner and we sat down, we ate dinner and you were just somewhere else. Like your head is just, was just elsewhere. And
I'd had a job interview that day and I was told that it was a no because I was too confident.
Yeah, and you, that hit you really hard. And I remember you got really upset and you said, it was actually quite ironic that they had said that you were too confident, because you said, I have no confidence in myself. Mm. How can they think I'm too confident when I have no belief in myself at all? And it was then that I was really starting to see like how much your self-confidence had been eroded by this process with the business. And, you know, I think you were going into these interviews and putting on a front that you thought that they would want to hire, you know, whilst having no belief in your own abilities. You were going in and pretending that you did, in the hope that they might not see how low your confidence was. And it actually, ironically, you had come over so confident they thought you were arrogant. And you were absolutely devastated by that. I remember you saying you didn't know who you were. And I think you started then to say, you know, you were kind of waking up and you were going to sleep at night, you didn't really want to wake up. Mm. And I remember thinking then, okay, this is serious. And I said having had no experience of this at all ever before, I said the only things that I thought sounded sensible to me, which were, don't worry about it, I promise it all will be okay. And then I think you left the room for some reason. I quickly grabbed my phone and like Googled what to say to someone who says they think they might be depressed. And it was like, do not say, I promise this will be okay. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? But because what I wanted to say was, oh, I totally understand. I'm totally that, like, we've all been there. Of course, I haven't been there at all. I promise it'll be okay. You know, I can't promise it's going to be okay. And so I kind of settled on, you're not alone.
You did.
As my kind of default go-to thing to say to you when you were opening up to me, you would say, this is how I'm feeling, this is what I'm going through. And I would just try to kind of put an arm around you and say, you're not alone, you're not on your own, I'm by your side. And that was kind of the safest thing that I thought I could say, that kind of showed you that I was next to you and I was supporting you. But also, you know, I just didn't want to say, I understand how you're feeling, because I just didn't.
What did it feel like hearing the words from somebody you love? I don't want to wake up tomorrow.
It's kind of, it's heartbreaking in two very different ways. It's heartbreaking just for you to think that you are so low that you don't want to wake up. That is so horrible to hear for someone that you care about, and anyone who's ever had a loved one who's felt like that will know what that feels like. That kind of, this person that I love, who has so much to give to the world, who is so fantastic, can't see any of that, because right now all he can see is the bad stuff. But I think also it's heartbreaking for me because, and on another level, because we're together and I'm such a big part of your life. And it's hard for me not to take that personally and think, well, am I doing something wrong here? Because he would rather not wake up than be with me. And that's personally really hard as well, because it's hard not to take that as a, not as a criticism, because I never felt like you meant it as a criticism, but it's hard not to take that to heart and feel like maybe I could be doing a better job or I'm doing something wrong.
Mm. We're now into mid, late January.
Yeah.
And there's a period of 7 weeks now where things got really bad.
Yeah.
I told you that I was feeling really, really low on the sofa, and I believe I was basically burst into tears and didn't stop crying for about 4 hours.
Yeah.
The next 7 weeks are brutal.
Mm. Yeah.
What happened?
It got worse, I think. I think you got worse. You certainly went, I think, kind of were slowly going downhill, and I couldn't stop that. You know, I couldn't kind of slow that down or hold that for you or pull you back out. And I was kind of felt pretty helpless, just kind of watching you kind of go through that. And I remember kind of pretty early on, actually, after you've had that first conversation with me, I reached out to a lady who I've seen for counselling in the past, a lady who I went to originally for bereavement counselling soon after my dad passed away. And I went back to her and said, you know, I just need some more support for myself, because for the next few weeks, I knew I was going to be giving so much to support you that I knew I needed some support for me. And so I started kind of seeing her, and obviously she, being kind of a counsellor and a therapist, she immediately was kind of identified that you needed to see someone and get some help. And she was encouraging me, sometimes very, very strongly, to get you some help. And I was trying to encourage you to get some help. But in general, that wasn't something that at the time, especially in the early stages, you were that open to.
No.
You were, I think it was great that you originally opened up to me, and I was kind of, I think I thought that kind of saying to you, great, you've told me, so now go to your GP. I knew that wasn't going to work. So I was kind of trying to encourage you to open up to more and more people. So I was saying, you know, why don't you have a chat with your mum? Why don't you have a chat with your best friend? Why don't you kind of just start to open up to some people around you? Because I kind of felt the more comfortable you were sharing it with people, the more you might be able to go to a GP. But then I did start pushing harder and harder for you to go to a GP. And I think you did try a couple of times. And I remember you calling the GP and they said, oh, you have to come and wait. And the queue is like 2 hours. And I just thought, and I remember you telling me that, and I just thought, even if you walk in there, there is no way you are going to sit there for 2 hours with your thoughts. And I was so disappointed, and I was so angry with the doctor's surgery that that was the best that they could do. Mm. That you were struggling the way that you were. You know, at the time, I think it was getting very clear that you were suicidal. And I was so angry because, you know, you obviously, it's very difficult for you to ring up a doctor's surgery and say to a lady you don't know on the phone, some receptionist, oh yes, I really need to see the doctor rather urgently because I'm suicidal. It's very hard to do that. So you were ringing up and saying, can I have an emergency appointment? And they were going, yeah, just come and wait. And it's so difficult because I was like, I get that they don't know because you haven't told them, but also potentially your life's at stake. Mm. And that's really frustrating to feel that they just aren't, that those services weren't there when you reached out for them.
Mm. We are Loose Heads, the rugby leisurewear brand, helping to raise awareness for mental health.
100% of the money raised by our foundation goes towards tackling the stigma.
You can find us at looseheads.co.uk or at looseheads on all social media platforms. You can now enter code RUT for 10% off your next order. Together, let's tackle the stigma. Take care. Go safe.
You talked about me being suicidal. Take me back to the instances when you were on the other end of the phone to me, really at my lowest.
Yeah, I think there were two really that stuck out in my mind as being, well, actually, you know, three instances that stick out in my mind as being when I was really, really worried that you weren't going to make it through the day. Mm. There was one at Edgware Road Station when you called and you were stood on the platform. And I think we're really tempted to do something there. And I remember kind of saying to you very early on, actually, what one conversation that we had, I said, whatever you do, just don't do anything stupid before you call me. Like, just call me first. If you feel like you have to act, like, I know you're having these thoughts, but if you feel like you have to act on them, just make one phone call first and just call me. And so obviously you did in the Earl's Court situation. And I remember saying to you, get on the tube, mm-hmm. and come to Hammersmith and I'll meet you there. And that, you know, you got on the tube and you got there. And then the other time was...
How did that feel?
Terrifying. Because I think kind of, I hung up and I thought, yeah, he's all right now. Kind of when obviously I'd answered the phone, you were in a state and I'd had a conversation with you and I felt like when I hung up, you were in a good state. But then there was that, what if something's happened? What if something happens that flips your mind again? What if you know, what I've said hasn't been enough or whatever? And then what? And then your mind starts to think, well, then what? What if you actually do something? Then what? And that takes you down an area of like a thought process that you just don't want to go down. You don't want to think about. And then there was the Putney Bridge situation where I remember, again, you called me from Putney Bridge, actually on the bridge. And you were partway across it and you said, I don't know if I can get across the bridge. And I had to basically talk you across the bridge. Starting with kind of saying, I'll be honest with you, James, that bridge is not very high and the water is very cold.
Remember that.
Really not worth it. If you're going to do something, this is not the way to do it. But kind of getting you back to my place in Putney from the bridge. And then there was a third time, and I'm struggling to place when it was, when you called me and you were in bed.
We went to the gym that morning and I'd left abruptly, which I never normally do because I come and say goodbye to you.
Yeah. And you'd gone home do something.
I've been in tears under the weights and then gone home to walk the dog.
And pick some stuff up. And then you just got into bed and you couldn't get out of bed. And you called me or I called you. I can't quite remember what happened, but I think I'd said to you, I tried to get in touch with you to see how you were getting on, and you kind of just said, I'm in bed, I'm crying and I can't get out of bed. And we spoke and I said, look, just get in the car and come to me.
Because I'd had this voice in my head and it was getting worse and worse. It's almost like a form of psychosis. And that voice had been in my head for the last 4 months. It was at its loudest, I think.
And I remember you saying, I just want it to stop. This voice just has to stop. I have to make it stop. It doesn't matter what I have to do, I just have to make it stop. And that was quite scary, to kind of think that that voice had got so loud and so unpleasant that you would have done anything to make it stop. And then that situation, I remember actually you saying, I remember saying to you, come to me, and you said, well, I can't because I'll be at your work at 4 and you aren't finished at 4. And I said, just come anyway. And once you'd actually faffed about, walked the dog, got yourself out of bed, stopped at KFC for some chicken on the way, actually you got to my work at 6 and I was done anyway. But yeah, that was the third time that I remember being quite scared.
We had a period of 4 weeks where I was living, we had this little saying, I was living for 6 o'clock.
Yeah, it was, we'd get up in the morning, we'd have a couple of hours, you'd drop me at work, and then it was just a countdown to 6 o'clock when I finished.
Yeah.
And as much as those hours must have been awful for you, they were pretty horrific for me as well, because I was obviously worrying about you doing my full-time job, which needs quite a lot of my attention and kind of headspace. And there were quite a few times that I broke down in tears at work.
Talk to me about those times.
I think it was just the pressure of kind of feeling like I was keeping you going. And I was in work and I'm trying to concentrate at work, and it does require, as I say, quite a lot of headspace. But I didn't really have that headspace to do it well. And so every time I went into a meeting, I had my phone on me. I was checking it all the time. If you hadn't messaged me for a couple of hours, I was panicking and finding a reason to message you. I was calling you to talk about dinner or whatever. I remember at one point you said to me, you don't need to keep calling me to make sure that I'm alive. And I thought, I kind of do. occasionally, I'd see on WhatsApp you were last seen 3 hours ago, and I'd be going, what? Where is he? What's he doing? Is he okay? And so I was really struggling, and I started kind of started speaking to a couple of people in work who I was friends with, and I was absolutely amazed, because the first girl I spoke to said, totally understand, my cousin's had mental health issues for a while and he's really struggled, and I was kind of thinking, okay, wow, there's someone else in the office who's been through this. And then the second person I told was like, yeah, my uncle committed suicide, totally understand where you're coming from. And then the third girl that I spoke to opened up to me about her mental health issues. Mm. And I was kind of thinking, wow, this is absolutely everywhere. Mm. But I just had... in that respect, I just had so many supportive people around me who were kind of going, don't be here, go home, don't worry about this piece of work, this can wait. And actually, I have to say also, I spoke to our HR department at work and they were unbelievable.
They were amazing.
Yeah. I mean, they were like, you need some support. Yeah. Here's our employee helpline. Take whatever time you need. They were asking how they could help you. They were absolutely incredible. They were there for, a hug, a cup of tea, absolutely everything. Totally relaxed about me taking,
I mean, in many respects, time. Both of our lifelines.
Absolutely. I mean, if they'd been tougher about it, but they were absolutely incredible. And yeah, that really took a lot of the weight off when I kind of told enough people at work. That was just such a relief to kind of know I had their support. And that actually also just meant that, coming into, must have been kind of February then, when you were really at your lowest, I remember we kind of had a conversation about going away.
Mm.
And potentially just the idea of just everything in your life, everything that you saw every day was a reminder of kind of negative things and was kind of reinforcing those negative thoughts. And so we just thought the best thing to do might be for you to just completely come away from it.
Yeah, so extricate myself from England.
Yeah.
London.
Yeah, Europe. And so we went to a travel agent. We must have been their dream because we kind of walked in and said, we don't know where we want to go, but it's miles away, and just sort it all out, please. And they did. And we booked a holiday to Bali. And again, work were great because at 2 weeks' notice, I said, I need to leave for 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, it is a matter of James's life or death. Mm. So I'm going. And they said, absolutely, whatever you need, take it. And so we kind of had that.
Something to look forward to.
To look forward to, yeah. Mm. And I think that kind of gave us...
And when my car floated down the River Thames, it didn't really matter, did it?
I mean, that was like the icing on the cake. Mm. And of course, the irony of the fact that we were sitting there talking about how things really couldn't get any worse.
Yeah.
And we were really kind of saying Europe...
Creating a mind map of my happiness, actually.
Yeah. We were like, you're at rock bottom.
Yeah,
you can't get any lower.
Oh well, my car was actually at the bottom of the River Thames.
Oh well, your car was floating down Thames, in that now infamous story. But yeah, I remember in one of those conversations we did actually we kind of created a mind map of what made you happy, what made us happy as a couple, and we just kind of wrote down everything that made us happy, and it was our family, our friends, our life experiences. Nowhere on that map was success or job. And I think that was amazing because that kind of showed how far you'd come in 9 months from a point where you'd laughed at me saying, I want to be happy, to a point where actually you completely abandoned this, or trying to abandon this concept of success as your kind of life's aim, and trying to aim for that kind of happiness and trying to work out what it was that would make you happy.
I've suffered from depression, what we now know, suicide ideation basically, but it got pretty bad, and anxiety. You've lived with me really recently when I've had bad anxiety. What has that been like to deal with from your perspective?
It's really, really difficult because it's, I have to say, I kind of oscillate between two extremes. I have one end where I really sympathize and I just think this must be absolutely awful for you, and I can totally understand how you got here and it's really hard and poor you kind of feeling. I'm really feeling sorry for you and really wanting to do whatever I can to help. And the other end, which frankly is frustration. And I had moments quite early on in the process of watching you go through this where I was very frustrated because I didn't understand how you could be depressed, because I would look at your life from where I sat and I'd say, you have all of this. How can it be that you look at what you have in your life and you see a glass that's mostly empty, but I see a glass that's almost full? And that, I couldn't wrap my head around that. And it's really hard, I think, when you've got another half who's struggling and you're trying to sympathize and you're trying to understand, but you just can't understand. Mm. But I think it helped me to think about, kind of try and put myself in your shoes and try and think about really kind of going back through everything you've been through. Mm. Not just you had a couple of job rejections, but to really go back through everything and to see how so much of your life had come apart.
Mm.
over the previous 9 months. And that was, yeah, okay, it was the business, it was the job rejections, but it was also the knee, the drinking, the social life reduction, the car. And it really, and then also, you know, the work that you've done with a life coach, which have been, I think, really valuable, but had also started to unpick so much that you had thought was important.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of like your entire life had been picked apart. And every time you had been, I kind of visualized it as you were kind of drowning. And every time you came up for air, something just came and pushed you back down again.
Mm.
And in that context, it made it easier for me to understand where you were coming from. And that made it easier for me to kind of empathize with where you were.
Mm.
Because I just found it so difficult to begin with to see how you could be upset at what you had, at your kind of lot in life. But of course, as we know, mental health doesn't discriminate between people who have money or people who have status or people who have, you know, whatever background or...
You've mentioned your job. You've mentioned me and the pressures that that's put you under. What other pressures were you under during that time? And because there was a few different things that... I suppose gave the impression that there was significant upheaval in your life, in both of our lives as a couple.
Yeah, I think there are probably quite a few kind of things that were going on in my life that impacted how I was able to support you. I think kind of just to go backstage, when I was trying to be supportive of you, inevitably there were times when that hit upon my personal issues, as it were, and certainly kind of things that I thought weren't really an issue anymore. So I remember, for example, one of the times that you called me when I was at work, I was on the phone to my boss, and I had told her a lot of what had been going on, but I was on the phone to her on my work phone talking through a contract or something, and you rang me on my mobile, and I could see that you were ringing me, and I'm thinking, I've got to answer James, because I don't know where he is, I don't know what he's thinking, I don't know what he's reaching out for, it could be really important that I answer now, but I'm on the phone to my boss, and how do I deal with that? And I got really, really panicked about it. And then looking back on that, and when I was talking to my counselor about that, actually my panic about that was around, what if I miss that call and then you do something, and then I then am thinking, what if I answered the call? What would have happened? Would I have changed anything? Would anything have gone differently? That's kind of probably a relatively normal thought process for anyone to go through. I found that really difficult because from my own personal experience, my dad tried to call me the day before he died. And I didn't answer the phone. It went to voicemail and he left me a voicemail. And I picked it up that day and I thought, I'll call him back tomorrow. And he died and I never spoke to him. And that's something that I have come to terms with in the past with my bereavement counsellor in relation to that situation with my dad. But when that came back round again with you, and I was thinking, what if that's the second time that happens? The second time I miss a call and someone that I love and care about dies. How will I forgive myself? So that kind of also dug into things in my past that I honestly didn't know were going to happen. And I think that's why it's been so valuable for me to have someone that I can lean on, that I can talk to during this time, because I don't think I'd have been able to be anywhere near as supportive as I have been. And it's allowed me to actually say the stuff that I don't feel I can say to you straight up. So the stuff where I say, you know, it was her that I first said, how can he be feeling this? He's got so much. If I'd said that to you, that probably wouldn't have been a very productive conversation. But because I was able to share it with her in a space where, you know, she was able to kind of challenge that with me and kind of help me understand it, that meant that I didn't have to say that directly to you. And we didn't have to have that kind of conversation, which might have been really difficult for you. And you might have come away thinking, well, Abby doesn't understand, so I don't want to talk to her anymore. Yeah. So the value of me having someone to talk to has just been incredible. Yeah. And I think we've both noticed that it's meant that I've just been able to kind of focus on being there for you.
There was periods of times when we were moving between flats and houses, and there's a other pressure there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a difficult time because obviously you having had the business situation that happened, and that was something that I think you very closely associated with your house because you've been working there. And so as you started to struggle more and more, you wanted to spend less time physically in that environment, and just kind of, I think, kind of silly things like rooms just reminded you of, had those negative thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, there's a period of, extended period of time where it's giving me panic attacks going back home.
And so you were kind of spending more and more time at my flat, which I shared with my sister. So, you know, there was also, I mean, it's a two-bedroom flat, there's a fair amount of space, but it's cozy for three. And I think, you know, my sister likes her own space, and you know, fair enough, she doesn't want her sister's boyfriend there every day. So I think there was a difficulty there as well, because I didn't want you to go back home. But I also wanted to try and be respectful of my sister's half of the flat. And in the end, to be honest, you just had to come here to my flat. There wasn't really a choice. And I tried for as long as I could to kind of balance that. But in the end, it just became, your negative reaction to the house was so bad that I just didn't want to risk you going back there. And so I just thought it was best for you to just be in my flat. And it felt to me like it was as a matter of life or death. So I just kind of had to just make that decision. And I did talk to her about it, and I said, you know, James is having a really tough time and he needs to be at ours, because he needs just a different environment. Because, you know, I didn't want that kind of spiral of negativity to start again with you going back home. And I don't know that she quite understood how serious it was with you, I don't know. But in any event, yeah, it was obviously something that was difficult to manage.
What impact has this had on you?
I think it's been a pretty intense thing for us to go through, quite an early stage in our relationship, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, it's made us incredibly strong.
Yeah. I think think it's what I've noticed, not just from you, I think you have changed a lot the past year or so since we met. You have changed hugely. I mean, and we've had a couple of conversations with this. I don't actually think that your like inner characteristics have changed that much. You still have a lot of the same qualities. You just are kind of focused on channeling them in a different way, which I think is really good. That's a hugely positive change. But I think in me, I've noticed that I've become a lot more focused on the same things. Like whilst I've been encouraging you to prioritize what makes you happy, I've kind of realized I'm going to need to follow the same rules. And so it's helped me to kind of refocus as well a little bit. And I think you said the other day, like, you know, you think I've changed a lot in the last year or so as well.
Massively, yeah.
And I think that's been kind of seeing you go through this, I've kind of refocused on, okay, well, actually what really matters, what really makes us happy, what makes me happy. And I think I've probably had a relatively healthy approach to kind of work-life balance and things like that in the past, but it certainly kind of helped me focus on what really matters and what I want to kind of focus my time on, and, you know, working to live rather than living to work. I think it's been really healthy for me. I think I've noticed that
which change. Is strange, actually.
Well, I mean, I think that change has been really healthy for me. I think because I've noticed in that, you know, it made me really stop and think about my job and my career. And actually, I thought it made me stop and have a bit of a think. But then I thought, well, actually, you know, no, actually, I love my career and I get a huge amount of fulfillment from it. But I get fulfillment from these bits of it. So it kind of made me make an active decision with what I wanted to stay with, rather than kind of passively just carrying on for another 30 years. Which I think is great, because I would hate to have turned around in 30 years' time and gone, God, I wish I hadn't done that for the last 30 years. And it made me kind of stop and rethink and make an active decision to carry on doing what I like, rather than just to not change anything.
And the emotional impact?
I think it's been huge. But I think it's been huge day to day. I think it's taken a huge toll on me. I think it's been a huge personal kind of strain and pressure on me. Not one that I, you know, resent you for at all. But it has taken a toll on me, absolutely. But I think it's one of those things that when I've watched you go through it, I know I am seeing, sometimes before you see, a real positive change. I've started to see, especially since, you know, you got back from that holiday and starting to see you kind of come out of the rut that you've been in, I've started to see a really positive change in you. And I also,
what have you seen?
Just like refocusing on things that are important, and actually kind of giving yourself time to just be kind to yourself and letting yourself off the hook a bit. Not something that you ever did before.
No, my own worst critic.
Yeah, and actually kind of occasionally just saying, do you know what, I'm just going to have a self-care day. Or I'm just going to go off and meditate for 20 minutes. Absolutely huge improvements. But yeah, I just think, I think, as I say, I sometimes see those improvements before you do. But also I sometimes see you starting to slip into negative ways again before you do.
What do you notice when those little episodes come about? Because they do come about. There are days and often weeks where,
yeah, it's more you kind of just seem a little bit distracted. Your head is somewhere else. You're focusing somewhere else, and you will just things like, you know, we'll be making a meal or we'll be sitting watching TV and you're just not paying attention to what we're doing. You're just somewhere else.
And how do you deal with that? What do you do?
Usually, as I say, I see it before you do. So now I think I'm pretty quick off the mark to say, James, you're not with me. You're somewhere else. What? Where are you? And then you'll usually now, you're quite open about it and you'll say, I've been having these weird thoughts about whatever. And then we're kind of able to get on it quickly.
When I'm not open about it, how do you deal with that?
Well, I think you pretty much are. But I mean, I certainly think kind of the first couple of times it happened, it probably took you a week to start agreeing with me. And then the second time, and then, you know, you made another appointment with Simon, who's this amazing guy who you've been seeing.
Amazing. Saved my life in many respects.
Yeah. And, you know, you've had that kind of session with him, you know, you've maybe got in touch with him a week after I first said something. But then the second time, you know, it's maybe come up on Friday and by the Monday you're on the phone to him trying to set something up. And then the other day, you know, it was literally the same day. I was like, James, where are you? You're somewhere else again. Where are your thoughts going? And you were like, oh, I've been having these feelings. I was like, right, get on to Simon again. Just to try and give you some more techniques to manage the things that you're struggling with. So it's very much a kind of ongoing management kind of thing. But it feels like you're out of the worst of it, which is great. And I think you still have kind of weeks that are really positive and weeks that aren't, but they're definitely kind of fewer and less intense when they are bad. And I think now we're in quite a good routine of kind of getting you out of them, knowing when to recognize them.
You know the reason why I started this podcast. Talking for me was the best thing I ever did. It took me a while to do it, but I did it. Yes, things got worse before they got better. From your experience and perspective, what's the impact of talking been for me and for you? And how important was it?
I think it's been the single most important thing that you've done in all of this. And it's, for me, talking to someone else has been the most important thing that I've done. Because as soon as you started talking, we could start to understand and start to sympathize and start to get you some help. And before that point, even though I kind of suspected, I didn't really know, and I wouldn't have done anything. But as soon as you started talking, even just that first conversation, that started the ball, the like wheels in motion, towards getting you some help, in whatever form that was going to be. But it just felt like that was the first step in the right direction. And then that enabled you and I to, even just those first few conversations that were just you and me on our sofa, those were huge for then getting you to be able to open up to other people. And I think then, you know, the more you opened up, the more positive responses you got. I think there was probably a bit of a fear from you that you weren't going to get, you know, positive kind of responses, but actually there were some incredible responses.
Amazing responses
from a lot of people who'd been through similar things or could relate. And as soon as you started talking, things started getting better. And as soon as it's the same now you start having thoughts and I notice it before you tell me, but actually as soon as you start talking, then it improves. And from my perspective, I couldn't have done any of this. I couldn't have been any kind of support to you without having my own support, and especially having my own counsellor to talk to, because
she's
just been incredible for that.
You've been through this with me, depression, anxiety, on the verge of wanting to end my life, well, being at the stage where I want to end my life. You've been with me 24/7 in the process of coming out of the rut. And now we're on this, I suppose, relatively even keel. Sometimes we fall off that keel and into the sea and have to swim back to the top. What advice? I want to know what advice you'd give from your experiences to people who are supporting people or might even suspect somebody has depression, prolonged negative thoughts, anxiety, is in a bad place. What would you do?
I think there's hopefully two key things that that person might take out of what I've said already so far and what I'll say now, which is you've got to try and support that person, but you've got to support yourself as well. So I think, you know, it kind of goes without saying that you're going to want to reach out to someone who you're concerned about. And I think I'd absolutely encourage you to do that to the extent that you feel that you can, even if that's just a, how are you feeling? How was your day? Kind of conversation, kind of, I think what I tried to do with you was just kind of ask really open-ended questions and then just shut up.
Just you had to get very good at listening.
Yeah, just kind of let you talk. It's really interesting. I think people tend to want to fill an empty space. So if someone's talking and then they finish, but you don't say anything, they'll often carry on. So I tried to just ask you how your day was, and then when you said fine, kind of just not jump in with my day.
No, you used to give me a little look.
Yeah.
As if to say, are you sure?
And that was actually hard, because to be honest, in general, you'd spent the day around the flat, not doing a lot. I'd had a day at work and I had loads of things to talk about, but I actively tried to just let you talk. And then just to kind of encourage you to just keep talking to people and just say, I think you should try and have a conversation with your mum. Have you tried this? And I mean, I must have sent you on like a million wild goose chasers. I think I sent you to the Samaritans.
I went to the Samaritans.
Yeah, there just happened to randomly be a Samaritans round the corner. So I suggested you popped in
for 10 minutes and hated every second of it.
I suggested you call your GP. I suggested you speak to your mum. I suggested counsellors, therapists, psychologists, whatever, just kind of, and to your credit, I think you tried pretty much all of them. So I think kind of, obviously you want to try and get with that person who might be struggling to kind of open up. But I also felt that it was really, really important that once you opened up to me, that I kept that in confidence and that I wanted you to share, not me. And it would have been very easy for me to pick up the phone and call your mum. But I just thought, this is really not the time for me to do that, because I have to encourage you to do it, but also you have to feel that you can trust me. And if I do that and then you find out, then that's going to potentially destroy the only conversation that you're having. So I just kind of tried to encourage you the right way, kind of keep you knowing that I was there, and then just try and make sure that I was getting the support as well that I needed in order to do that, because it is exhausting. It is really tiring looking after, being there for someone in that situation, because it is just emotionally so tough, for all the reasons that we've talked about. So I think it's really important as well for the person who's supporting the person who's struggling with their mental health to have their own support network, whether that's like friends, family. And I mean, I have amazing friends and family. It's not that I didn't have that, but just to have kind of an extra layer was just incredible. I wouldn't have been able to do it without it.
One of the first episodes I ever wanted to record when I had this idea for this podcast was an episode with you, because I have seen, and at times it's been really difficult for me because I can visually see the impact it has on you. I can emotionally see the stress it puts on you. Yeah, there isn't much I can do. Often there are times that I can help it and you've got really upset and I've had to spring into right fight mode and sort of fucking out, right, okay, pull yourself together right now, get out of this place, and I have done. But this is one of the most important episodes I will do of this podcast, because it is something that is not spoken about much at all. The people out there who are suspecting, supporting, worried about somebody who might be suffering with extended negative thoughts, depression, anxiety, and it is a complete minefield, as you know. And I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you. I've told you a few times that you saved my life.
Yeah.
And you have.
Yeah.
And it's been such a difficult 10 months, 8 months for me, and 6 months for us since I started talking about it. But I want to say thank you for opening up, because what you've spoken about today is difficult, and people out there should know that it's not just the person who's feeling the effects of depression, anxiety, negative thoughts, that this is having an impact on the people around them. And you are a first-hand account of that.
Yeah. We were talking the other day, and one of the things you said was, I live with this every day. And I said, so do I.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do live with it every day, but it's just so important in this situation that we do it together. And we take every step you take in the right direction, we do together. And I'll be by your side for that. And it's so important for both of us to get through it together. But we both need to support each other and need our own kind of separate support. And I think it's great to kind of push out what the support network for someone who's struggling does, because I didn't know where to start, where to look, who to turn to. But there are actually resources out there if you look, and it's great to have more of them, because we've got to talk about this, and we've got to make some progress on these numbers for men. And hopefully we can do that by having some more honest conversations. Hopefully that'll be between men, but also, you know, with their supporters, their other halves.
Should we have a hug?
Next time on The Rut, I sit down with former New Zealand under 20, Leicester Tigers, Harlequins, and now Worcester Warriors scrum half, John Okitto, for an epic episode. See you then.